Hello and welcome to The Fairy Folk, the podcast that takes you on a magical tour to discover the myth and the magic of the United Kingdom without leaving the comfort of your own home. Now, normally, we'd be covering two different stories from across the UK, but today's extra long episode is dedicated to one of the most famous folkloric and cryptozoological creatures of all time, the Loch Ness Monster, or Nessie to her friends. There's plenty of folklore, fantasy, history, and skepticism ahead, so get ready for today's wild ride. Our story begins at a lake known as a loch in local dialect in the Scottish Highlands. You can easily spot the blue slither of Loch Ness when looking at a map of the UK. It slices right through the land across Whitefield and Drumna Drocket, giving you a good impression of just how large this body of water truly is. To put it into perspective, the loch is 23 miles long, roughly the same distance from England to France across the English Channel. Brenda Sherratt, who became the first person to swim the length of the loch in 1966, completed her mammoth swim in 31 hours, 27 minutes, and the current record holder at the time of recording managed the feat in 11 hours and 38 minutes. Loch Ness is as deep as it is vast. Initially, it was thought to be bottomless, but now we know the true depth of the loch and that its deepest point reaches around 754 feet below. You could pile up the Tower of Big Ben three times in the loch and still not reach its surface. It is the largest lake in the British Isles and one of the deepest in Europe. The water is murky, cold, and dark. The perfect place for a monster to hide. I first visited Loch Ness in 2009, and I remember being transfixed by the beauty of the area. With so much focus on the loch and the creature that may or may not live within it, it's easy to forget just how beautiful this part of Scotland truly is. Green hills surround the area with forests of evergreen trees and bracken beside concrete roads that cruise along the vast loch. The historic ruins of Urquhart Castle are another stunning feature of the loch, a popular tourist destination in its own right, and often painters and photographers favour the site as a centrepiece of their works. But most tourists don't visit the loch for its castle, or its stunning views, or even for a swim. No, most tourists visit Loch Ness to get a glimpse at its most famous resident, the Loch Ness Monster. The Loch Ness Monster is what we would call a cryptozoological creature. That means a creature whose existence is disputed and remains, as yet, definitively unproven. Other examples would be the Himalayan Yeti or the Mothman of West Virginia. But the most famous cryptozoological creature is undoubtedly the Loch Ness Monster herself, whose existence has even been traced back to the 6th century AD. Now, as there's such a large collection of stories, photographs, and scientific findings all related to the monster, it would take me hours to cover it all. So today I will present to you some of the most famous sightings and stories related to the Loch Ness Monster to hopefully give you a brief overview of history's most prolific hide-and-seek champion. Though there may have been some pre-Christian allusions to the Loch Ness Monster in ancient carvings, it's Irish St. Columba's encounter with the creature in 565 AD that is usually thought of as being the first documented encounter with the creature. He firmly believed that it had been his divine calling to bring Christianity to Scotland. And now he spent much of his time preaching the word of God to the native Picts. But one day, he was approached by some of his followers with news of a strange encounter that they had had with some of the locals. Beside the River Ness, they had seen a group of men, faces distraught, as they solemnly buried one of their own. The reason, they later claimed, that this man had died was because of a water beast that had risen up from the depths and attacked him whilst he swam. A rescue boat was sent out, but it arrived too late. St. Columba listened intently as the story unfolded, but it was only later, when one of his own followers was caught swimming across the river, did St. Columba come to realise the truth behind the story of the water beast. It was lurking, not too far from the riverbank, and rose up from the depths to face the monk. But he remained calm and commanded the creature to leave and go no further. And that, combined with the sign of the cross, was enough to drive the water beast away. This encounter was documented in the life of St. Columba, but it's important to note that this was published an entire century after the supposed events happened, so crucial details of the story may have been lost or embellished with time. Because the incident occurred so long ago, it's hard to confirm much of the story's validity, but that has not stopped it from becoming one of the most famous encounters with the monster, and was quite possibly the event that spawned the legend of the Loch in the first place. Not much more was heard from the creature after that incident, and it managed to remain hidden for decades. Did the encounter with St. Columba scare the creature away for a while? Or is the current Loch Ness Monster a curious descendant of the first creature? Either way, it wasn't until the early 20th century that legends of the monster would really begin to resurface. Though rumours started to spread of a strange spectacle in Loch Ness from around 1916 onwards, it was the account from London tourists Mr. and Mrs. Spicer in 1933 that sparked the frenzy of Loch Ness monster hunting that would dominate the area for the next few decades. It was a warm July afternoon when the Spicers made their way down from Inverness, cruising along the road beside Loch Ness in their convertible. But they spotted something strange in the road ahead of them. A prehistoric-looking creature with what seemed like a small animal of some kind clenched within its jaws. But as they moved further along the road, the creature, or whatever it was, had already disappeared. The sighting was recorded in the Inverness Courier the following month, finally giving the much-sought-after validity to all the rumours, whispers, and legends that had surrounded the loch for years. This supposed eyewitness testimony described the creature in detail, including some of its now more familiar features, like its long neck and high back. Mr. Spicer described it as being similar to a dragon or prehistoric creature. However, his accounts didn't come without criticism, as even the newspaper in which the article was published suggested that it was likely an otter, perhaps carrying a young cub in its mouth. But whatever the Spicers had seen didn't truly matter, as this account in many people's eyes proved that there was, indeed, a monster in Loch Ness. The number of sightings dramatically increased, and journalists from around the world hopped on the story. Bertram Mills Circus even offered a reward of £20,000 for a safe capture of the creature, which would have been over £1 million in today's money. And so tourists, newspapers and self-styled monster hunters began the race to be the first to prove the creature's existence to the world. Nowadays, there's a plethora of photographs, many in black and white, of phenomena that claim to be the Loch Ness Monster, but the very first was taken on the 12th of November, 1933. It was a cold day, but Hugh Gray still clutched his camera carefully. There was something strange moving through the water. Could this be it? He thought to himself, the creature that everyone had been talking about. He hadn't set out with monster hunting in mind when he headed off for his walk that morning, but now here he was, a mere 100 yards away from the beast. He snapped a few photographs before it once again disappeared, and he put his camera away, unsure if any of the exposures would reveal the creature that he had just seen emerge from the loch. The pictures weren't developed until the following month, as Gray had begun to doubt whether any of them actually caught what he had seen that day. Four of these pictures were blank, but the fifth showed something strange. A blurry, snake-like creature wriggling its way through the loch, water spray and waves thrashing at its side. Was this it? Had he finally captured an image of the creature for all to see? The press certainly thought so. As pictures popped up in newspapers in both Glasgow and London, experts concluded that the picture wasn't tampered with and had truly captured whatever it was that Mr. Gray had seen that day. But what had Mr. Gray seen? Some sceptics suggest that it could have been anything from a large seal to a porpoise. There's also a very famous interpretation of the photograph that claims that it's actually a picture of a very blurry Labrador holding a stick in its mouth. It's also curious that the photograph went undeveloped for so long. But back in 1933, this was a big deal and led to some very notorious characters making their way over to the Scottish Loch with money, fame and monster hunting on their minds. It was the Daily Mail who were behind the 1933 end-of-year expedition to the Loch to search for and hopefully find the elusive creature. The expedition leader was Marmaduke Wetherill, the big game hunter turned movie star, who intended to use his hunting skills to finally capture the creature. It seemed a little too good to be true, but after only 3 days of their lochside vigil, Wetherill stumbled upon a series of large footprints. The rest of the team couldn't believe their luck, and the Daily Mail triumphantly published the headline, "Monster at Loch Ness is not a legend, but a fact." A plaster cast of the prints was sent over to the National History Museum in the hope of validating this monstrous find. But the museum's zoology department soon revealed the science behind these too-good-to-be-true prints. At first, it all looked promising that the prints were not immediately identifiable as a known aquatic mammal. However, the following year they released the damning conclusion of their findings. The prints matched with those of a hippopotamus. A dead hippopotamus, to be exact. But it was supposed that the hoax had been created by an umbrella stand or an ashtray made from a taxidermy hippo foot. And whether it was the left or right foot depends on which source you read. It was a mortifying find, and everyone blamed Wetherill for the hoax. Eventually he left, but not before claiming that the creature was actually a large seal that he had spotted when, conveniently, everyone else had turned their heads. But Marmaduke Wetherill's influence on the legend of the Loch Ness Monster did not end there, as we shall soon find out. Now, what image do you imagine when you hear someone mention the Loch Ness Monster? Do you perhaps picture a small, dark silhouette of a creature with a tiny head and arched neck protruding from the waves around it? If so, it's likely you're thinking of the surgeon's photograph. The black and white picture is considered one of the most famous photographs of the monster, and you'll likely see it reproduced in newspaper articles, book covers, and tourist merchandise. This famous image was said to have been captured by a London gynecologist and surgeon, Robert Kenneth Wilson, in 1934, and it sent the world into an absolute frenzy. It was another exclusive for the Daily Mail. The front page clearly showed the unusual object sticking out of the loch. The monster stories had been building for a while, and after the failure of Wetherill's expedition, the public and press alike were waiting, eager for another scoop. Wilson claimed that he had snapped a few photographs when he noticed a commotion on the loch, and then saw a strange creature rise out of it. It was even suggested that someone else who witnessed the strange appearance cried, "My God, the creature!" One of the pictures, when developed, showed the iconic image of the creature's head and neck, which became known as the surgeon's photograph, as at the time Mr. Wilson wanted to preserve his anonymity. His profession added a kind of credibility to the story too, and the newspaper confirmed that the picture had not been tampered with in any way. Many saw this front page exclusive as the first real clear evidence of the creature's existence. The photograph remained famous for years, and was even analysed by NASA in the 1970s. But skeptics felt that the picture was simply too good to be true. Was it, in actual fact, a piece of driftwood, or perhaps an otter's tail? The picture, that was usually shown in newspaper articles, was actually a cropped version of the original, presumably to make the creature, or whatever it was, seem large and imposing. But in reality, the full picture reveals the shore at the other side of the loch. What seem like waves in the foreground are actually more like ripples, implying that whatever was photographed was in fact much smaller than the Daily Mail's version might have you believe. The surgeon, who was apparently behind the photograph, was also inconsistent in his account of where and at what time the picture was taken. And then, in 1994, the truth surfaced. A man named Christian Sperling revealed that back in 1934, he was approached by his father-in-law, who asked him to craft a model of the creature's infamous head and neck, which was then attached to a toy submarine. The model was placed in the loch, and so it was this, and not the monster, that actually appeared in the famous surgeon's photograph. The picture, it turned out, was not taken by Mr. Wilson at all. He was merely a front man. No, the true photographer was Ian Wetherill, the stepson of Marmaduke Wetherill, the disgraced big game hunter, who, if you'll remember, apparently faked those Nessie footprints the year before. The original hoax may have been unveiled pretty quickly, but the legacy of this, the so-called surgeon's photograph, would go on to dupe generations of people for much longer than Weatherall could ever have imagined. He certainly got the ultimate revenge for his ridicule in the press. And though we know the truth behind this classic photograph now, at the time, it was still thought by many to be genuine, including by Tim Dinsdale, a man who, after a chance sighting, eventually dedicated his entire life to proving the creature's existence. Tim Dinsdale is one of the most well-known names connected with the Loch Ness Monster mystery. He was an engineer turned monster hunter and published many books on the creature, such as The Story of the Loch Ness Monster and Project Waterhorse, the true story of the monster quest at Loch Ness. On his first trip to the Loch, Dinsdale spotted the monster early, on the morning of April 23rd, 1960, the day he was actually supposed to leave the Loch. He spotted something strange on the water and managed to capture the creature on film as it swam around back and forth before submerging. Dinsdale was hoping that his film would help convince the scientific community of Nessie's existence, but it mostly attracted attention from the press, and the BBC even broadcast the footage during their Panorama news programme. Almost 10 million people tuned in. Though Dinsdale was thoroughly convinced that what he had captured was the monster, many people now believe that he had actually just filmed a small boat out on the horizon of the Loch. Some have pointed out that as the footage was shot on the day that Dinsdale was due to leave, he may have been so desperate to see something that he convinced himself that what he had seen was undoubtedly the monster. That being said, Dinsdale did also shoot some footage of a passing boat to prove that its movement was different to what he had captured, and the film still splits opinion to this day. Photographic evidence has always been an important part of the search for the Loch Ness Monster. It adds authenticity to eyewitness accounts, allowing the public to make up their own minds on what they think the image truly captured. The press also had a keen interest in Nessie sightings, and their articles almost always thrust these photographers, amateur or otherwise, into the spotlight. Some photographs seem to be captured with the best intentions, of strange anomalies spotted on the Loch. Others were deliberately staged for fame, as pranks, or in the case of the surgeon's photo, for revenge. And so, some of the classic pictures of the monster from the early days of the search are now thought to be hoaxes, such as Lachlan Stewart's snap from 1951, which looks much more like three floating hay bales than the body of a monster. There's also many of Frank Ciel's too-good-to-be-true photographs from the 1970s that were quickly debunked, and now the majority of his Nessie photographs are thought to have been deliberate fakes. However, there were some photographs that were not so easy to define. Dr. Robert Rhines and his team from the Academy of Applied Science travelled to the Loch from America in 1972 to conduct some research and to look for the famed monster. Rhines was able to locate any unusual shapes beneath the water and then attempt to photograph them using an underwater camera. Excitement built when one of the pictures clearly revealed an almost diamond-shaped fin. This picture became known as the Flipper. Two further underwater photographs were taken in 1975, completing the trio of Rhines photographs. One was thought to be of Nessie's head. It showed a strange, gnarly-looking thing, unlike any creature known to the natural world. This was nicknamed the Gargoyle, but the other photograph was truly sensational. It appeared to show the small body and long neck of a creature that looked very similar to a prehistoric plesiosaur, a type of underwater dinosaur. Could the Loch Ness Monster be a plesiosaur, or a descendant of a type of plesiosaur that had somehow escaped extinction? This theory began to increase in popularity after these photos were published, and painter and naturalist Sir Peter Scott even suggested that Nessie should be given her own scientific name, that I shall try my best to pronounce, Nessiteris rhombopteryx. That means Ness inhabitant with a diamond-shaped fin. Scott was one of the founding members of the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau, a group that was formed in 1962 to carry out a constant surveillance of the Loch. Unfortunately for Scott, it was pointed out that the name Nessitaris rhombopteryx was also an anagram of monster hoax by Sir Peter S. In 1975, some of Rhines' underwater pictures, amongst other evidence for the creature's existence, even prompted debate in Parliament, suggesting that the creature should be entitled to some guarantee of protection if it was ever to surface. The flipper photograph came under a lot of scrutiny over the years, much like the surgeon's photograph, and once again the truth was eventually revealed. The infamous flipper photograph had in fact been given a little pre-Photoshop enhancement. The image that was eventually published looked very different from the original captured by the underwater camera, and it had hardly any of the original fin-like diamond shape at all. The whole body and gargoyle head photographs have also since been scrutinized by experts. It seems that Rhines had not accounted for the underwater camera's distortion, and what he thought to be a giant creature was likely no bigger than a waft of sediment from the bottom of the loch. Funnily enough, the gargoyle head turned out to be a submerged tree stump that was retrieved in 1987 by Dick Rayner during Operation Deep Scan. Operation Deep Scan was a mission to sweep the loch with sonar technology to learn more about its ecology and to also keep an eye out for any lurking monsters. Sonar technology had been used to search the loch before, but this time an entire flotilla of boats were assembled to travel the length of the loch, emitting sound pulses and recording how they returned, in order to identify any anomalies. The project was thought up by Daryl Lawrence and Adrian Shine. Shine is one of the most well-known figures connected to modern-day and scientific monster hunting. An image of Shine cruising along the waters, clad in a tweed jacket, white beard and long hair blowing majestically in the wind, recently went viral for looking exactly like what you'd expect the head of the Loch Ness Discovery Project to look like. Shine came to Loch Ness as a hopeful young man aged just 23. He hopes that if Operation Deep Scan didn't uncover a hidden monster, it would at least help gather more scientific data on the loch. 19 boats took to Loch Ness across 2 days and recorded 3 notable moving contacts. But sadly, no physical evidence of the monster materialized. 2 of the contacts were thought to be leftover sonar reflections, but the third wasn't so easily explainable. Was Nessie simply too quick for the observing boats and managed to move away straight after the contacts were recorded? Or was this it? A definitive and disappointing end to the decades-long monster search? Although skepticism was beginning to outweigh true belief in the monster in many people's minds, Nessie has been captivating and intriguing the general public for generations. A reputation like that, and a strong tourism industry built around the legend, meant that sonar evidence or not, there was still, as far as many were concerned, a monster in Loch Ness. Monster hunters come and go, but there's one man that took up residency on the shore of Loch Ness in the 90s in search of the creature, and never left. And that man is Steve Feltham. His lifelong vigil began after he first travelled to the loch as a young boy and stumbled across the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau, who by that time had dropped the phenomena from their title and just become the LNIB. He was fascinated by their expeditions and was inspired to one day follow in their footsteps. And he did. When he was 28, he quit his job and headed to the loch, ready to search for the monster. His new home was a converted mobile library which he intended to use to travel around the loch. But when it was no longer fit for the road, it became his stationary home, perched at the side of the Dawes Inn on the northern side of the loch, with a gorgeous view. Initially, Feltham got lucky. In his first year, he spotted something speeding across the water like a torpedo. Something that seemed unexplainable. But now, 30 years later, he's still waiting for that second sighting. Feltham now holds the record for the longest continuous search at Loch Ness, and rightly so. And I'm sure that many, such as myself, are rather jealous of his peaceful lochside life and full-time Nessie hunter occupation. Although originally Feltham was searching for the plesiosaur-type creature of legend, he now believes that the Loch Ness monster is more likely a giant catfish or other known creature. But he continues his search, and also spends his spare time examining and debunking questionable Nessie sightings, as well as selling his unique clay models of the creature to passing tourists. Though the heyday of monster hunting was really the 1930s to the 1970s, it doesn't mean that the sightings have now ceased altogether, as there have actually been a few notable sightings from modern times too. Though the public have much less tolerance for fakes and hoaxes thanks to Photoshop and social media, that doesn't stop the odd sighting from popping up unexpectedly over the years. In 2003, the BBC made a documentary titled Searching for the Loch Ness Monster, which used satellite navigation technology to analyse the loch from above, hoping that one of their sonar beams would pick up a signal from something big within the loch. Sadly, the only thing the team picked up was a signal from one of their own test boys. 2007, however, saw the Holmes video gain traction when a lab technician named Gordon Holmes recorded the strange, submerged shape streak across the loch. Several news outlets picked up the story, some debunked it as being a group of otters or another natural loch dweller. But the video of the fast-moving creature is certainly unusual. In 2009, the Sun newspaper reported on a Nessie sighting that had been captured by a man named Jason Cook on Google Earth. The satellite map appeared to have captured a strange creature just below the surface of the water. Cook was quoted as saying that he believed the image to be just like the descriptions of Nessie. Some were quick to point out, though, that the strange blob was suspiciously boat-shaped. In 2011, Marcus Atkinson, a boat skipper on Loch Ness, recorded a sonar image of something that was 1.5 metres wide and 23 metres below the surface of the loch. And his photograph of the recording on the sonar won him the coveted Nessie Sighting of the Year prize. The next notable Nessie sighting was from David Elder in 2013. He snapped a picture of the mysterious wave at Fort Augustus towards the south end of the loch that gained quite a bit of attention. Elder insisted that the wave had to have been caused by solid objects beneath the water, but some believe it to be a wave, perhaps from a passing boat. Elder, however, insists that there was nobody else on the loch at the time. So, with no boats around, where did the wave come from? Another online map-based sighting came about in 2014 on Apple Maps when two men spotted what they thought was the monster, a strange giant fish-like shape near the surface of the water. The president of the Nessie fan club at the time said it looked like the wake of a boat, but with the boat itself missing. However, a man named Mick West tweeted that the creature was likely just a boat that had been lost from the original picture as the satellite's low-resolution images were stitched together. 2016 saw a sighting that turned out to be a little too good to be true. A robot from Norwegian company Kongsberg Maritime was searching the loch and revealed a perfect Nessie-shaped image. Any initial excitement, however, quickly died away when the team realised that the creature was likely the giant Loch Ness prop that sunk in the loch in 1969 during production on the film The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. Adrian Shine was quoted by the BBC News Scotland website as saying, "We have found a monster, but not the one people might have expected." And finally, that takes us to 2020, when a new sighting of the creature went viral in June. Taken by Steve Chalice on his visit to the loch the previous year, the clear image sparked a lot of online debate. The picture seems to show the grey speckled back of an unidentified creature swimming across the loch. The sceptical photographer initially believed the picture to be of a large catfish. However, believers were quick to suggest that what Chalice had actually captured was the Loch Ness Monster herself. However, the general consensus seems to be that whatever it was that Mr. Chalice managed to capture in his impressive photograph was probably not the mythic creature of legend. Though many of these modern sightings are now met with much more scrutiny and scepticism than those of the past, it seems that the general public are still keen for new sightings of the creature. And so for now, the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster, generations later, still continues. You can find many of the pictures and videos mentioned in today's podcast online. So why not hunt them down and decide for yourself whether you think anyone has actually managed to capture this elusive creature on film? Over the years, many people have proposed theories of what might really be lying beneath Loch Ness. Those on the sceptical side of things suggest that the famed monster sightings are actually a plethora of natural phenomena, such as driftwood, groups of seals, catfish, or a sturgeon, which is a kind of large fish. On the more supernatural side, one of the most popular theories is the plesiosaur theory, which suggests that the creature in Loch Ness was a prehistoric dinosaur that somehow managed to escape extinction. Or perhaps that the creature might be something not yet known to us. A completely new species with the humped back and arched neck of legend. Though these are the most popular theories, they certainly aren't the only ones. So, with the little time we have left, let me run you through a list of some of the other theories I've come across while researching the monster. Then I will leave it to you to decide what you really think is or isn't hiding in Loch Ness. So, if you're ready, let's begin. Some believe that the Loch Ness Monster, or at least some of the sightings of her, are actually of a floating tree trunk, a flock of swimming birds, a faraway boat, a large catfish, a plesiosaur, a flock of seals, a long-necked newt, a group of travelling circus elephants having a swimming break in the loch, a UFO, a group of otters, a kelpie, a sturgeon, a group of seals, a descendant of the original creature, waves caused by seismic activity, atmospheric distortion, a swimming stag or deer, a monster that did once exist but died a long time ago, a giant eel, a prototype submarine test, a dragon, a temperature inversion layer, a myth, a refraction of light, a mirage, an osprey, people's minds playing tricks, a long-necked seal called a pinniped, an arctic char, methane gas, people knowing about the legend and so expecting to see something, a ferox trout, underwater waves or seshes, the wake of a boat, a duck, or of course, a legendary, uncatchable monster. Funnily enough, I was too scared to visit Loch Ness when my dad suggested the idea on our very first trip to Scotland. I was scared of seeing the monster whilst no one else was looking, which meant I'd have a hard time proving that what I had seen was true. And that's certainly what many of the people we've come across in today's episode have had to deal with. Secretly, I sort of hope that we never find out whether or not the Loch Ness Monster truly exists, so that generations to come can still enjoy all of the myth, mystery and monster hunting connected to this legendary loch. And so that brings us to the end of our Loch Ness journey. Thank you so much for joining me today. This episode was a big one to put together, but I also love this opportunity to revisit the story of one of my favourite legends. If after today's episode you're now desperate to try and spot the monster for yourself, or like Steve Feltham, you're ready to become a full-time monster hunter, then why not take the trip to Loch Ness in the Scottish Highlands? You could perhaps journey up to the loch from Inverness. Although I should mention that it's not the easiest place to get to without a car, so if you do drive, you also get to enjoy some of the stunning views beside the loch. And you never know, you might see the creature heading across the road, just like the Spicers did in the 1930s. However, you can still reach the loch if you don't have a car at your disposal, as you can hop on the bus from Inverness that will drop you off nearby the loch. When you're there, there's plenty of boat trips and tours you can take, and you might just come away with your own Nessie sighting too. Drop into the Loch Ness Centre and Exhibition, or Nessieland, for a fun look at the monster's history. Or walk in the footsteps of St Columba and visit the historic ruins of Urquhart Castle. There's also some absolutely gorgeous views across the loch from there too. Now before I conclude today's episode, I'd like to take a moment to thank my brilliant sources. A creature such as Nessie has attracted the attention of many wonderful authors, bloggers, and photographers that have put together a brilliant array of books, films, blogs, and even plush toys, all based on the Loch Ness Monster. And so, here's just a few that have helped me put together today's episode. Some are well-loved books that have sat on my shelf since childhood, such as The Loch Ness Monster by James Carney and Colin Baxter Photography, and Nessie, The Loch Ness Monster by Richard Brassey, both of which have some beautiful pictures and illustrations that I've enjoyed flicking through over the years. Others are new finds, such as The Loch Ness Monster by Charles Fawkes and The Monsters of Loch Ness by Malcolm Robinson, that is so jam-packed with Loch Ness facts and monster creature lore that I'm still working my way through it now. But the biggest thanks must really go to Gareth Williams for his book, A Monstrous Commotion. I picked this book up last year, before the podcast had even begun, and it follows the history of the Loch Ness mystery in such a balanced way, choosing to focus on the people that have influenced the legend, as well as the historical events surrounding the loch, rather than trying to prove or disprove the existence of the creature itself. As you know, I'm a big fan of leaving things for people to make up their own minds on, so this book was an absolute delight, and one of the main sources and inspirations for today's podcast. So thank you, Mr. Williams, for your marvellous book. There are a few Loch Ness Monster documentaries that I also enjoyed re-watching to further my research. There's Desperately Seeking Nessie, which follows Steve Feltham's journey to becoming a full-time monster hunter, and Hidden Loch Ness, which takes a decidedly more scientific look at the Loch's history. You're more likely to come away from that one a skeptic than a believer, so perhaps avoid it if you're not yet ready to have your monster-loving heart broken. But the amount of time, effort, and research put into that programme is incredible, and I really enjoyed it. Steve Feltham's website, nessiehunter.co.uk, is also full of great photos and videos from his Loch side life, and you can follow his blog there to see whether he finally gets that second sighting. There's quite a few other podcasts that have also created episodes on the Loch Ness Monster, and everyone has their own way of approaching the topic. Episodes range from casual chats and conversations to hilarious discussions and more serious chronological retellings. So, if you have the time, do check out the offerings from Monster Talk, Creepy Crawling Cryptids, Crackpot, Scotland, a Scottish history podcast, and Unexplained Mysteries. Thank you to my parents, who took me on my first adventure to the Loch, and for all the museum trips and boat tours they were kind enough to take me on to satisfy my monster hunting cravings. And finally, thank you to all of you, the listeners, for joining me on this fantastic adventure. It's been great fun. The Fairy Folk will be back with another regular episode very soon. So, I suppose I shall see you all then. Goodbye! The music featured in today's episode was Galway and The Show Must Be Go by Kevin MacLeod. The rest of the music you've heard today, including the song that's playing now, was composed by Lawrence Owen, one half of Longcat Media, the team behind podcasts Mockery Manor and Madame Magenta. So, if you've enjoyed the music you've heard in today's episode, then you will find plenty more of that in their own offerings. And sound effects were from freesound.org.